All right. Hello and welcome back to Millennial 2020. And this is the 11th night, and this is the third of four streams. And this one is with Charlemagne. Charlemagne is part of the NRX, the Neo React. Well, in fact, Charlemagne, why don't you introduce yourself to the audience rather than me saying something that might be inaccurate? I don't want to get it wrong.
Absolutely. So, hello, pleasure to be on. Thanks for the invite. And I would describe myself as neo-reactionary. I'm heavily influenced by the work of Mencius Moldbug in particular. Recently, I've been digging into some of his influences. In terms of my political alignment, I consider myself aligned with the dissident right. I sort of came from the classical liberal track when I got interested in politics, and then I sort of shifted into more right-wing politics once I read Moldbug in 2017. And I consider myself firmly part of that community. In the general sense, recognizing things like the primacy of ethnos, religion, nation, that sort of thing. I am a Christian. Economically, I would say mostly Austrian, although I'm not, I don't use that doctrinally in terms of my political aims, I would say. And I guess right now, like many of the other people in the general NRX community, I'm sort of trying to figure out where to go from here. I think, as we've seen, Curtis Yarvin, as someone put it, is not nearly as interesting as Mencius Moldbug. And he's provided some interesting things recently in his blogs. You know, I think it's mostly still solid, but there is a sense, I think, of dissatisfaction, especially for us Americans with where Moldbug is trying to take NRX. And I think perhaps we can look deeper into the roots of neo-reaction to determine a better path forward, which we can get into next.
Yes, and I think you're absolutely right that we are at a crossroads when, and that's great. You know, if you, I like it, I like that we're back at this position that we were in 2015. Obviously, everything's changed, but it's similar to that situation in the sense that there is now a sense of possibility again and openness. This is a situation that I like. This is something that I'm at home with far more than being ideologically shrill and prescriptive. So I enjoy this situation. I think it's good. And I agree with you that we are, that there is a question of what to do, both in America, but and in Britain and in all these other European countries. I think that, and in Canada and Australia, of course, as well, all of these theatres, but the two, I think America is unique in the sense because it has the First Amendment and it has the Second Amendment, so that's its own thing. So you're dealing with quite a few different things here. But anyway, I've already gone into too much detail there. The point is that I think that there is a need to reappraise things and perhaps be more open minded than we have been in the last 5 years. So and definitely more inquisitive than we have been in the last 5 years. So okay. You wanted to talk about the background to NRX, but specifically in this stream, we're going to talk about James Burnham's the strand of thinking that starts with him and ends with NRX. So take it away and please explain who James Burnham was.
So James Burnham was, you could say, a conservative author who lived in the 20th century. He wrote several books. Probably his most important, I would say, and well-known one is The Machiavellians. I've also read The Web of Subversion by Burnham. And in The Machiavellians, Burnham basically describes Machiavellian political theory, which is essentially a scientific approach to politics. And I mean that in a very strict sense, not the sort of pseudoscientific understanding we have now, but actually examining the facts about how human beings actually are, especially in a perennial sense, and sort of removing all of the formalisms that come from ideology that are layered on top of that. So Burnham in The Machiavellians basically goes through a series of authors or political activists in sometimes both cases who he considers to be Machiavellian. You have people like Sorel, Michels, Mosca, Pareto. Pareto, I found, was the most interesting one.
But before you go into that, could you describe Machiavellianism again in more general terms? What actually, when people, you're right that there is a sort of everyday usage of that word, but there is a more specific usage. So could you go into that in more detail?
Yeah. So what Machiavellianism actually is it is approaching politics from the perspective of the real and not the formal. And it is an attempt, if you're a Machiavellian, your formal goals should be identical to your real ones. So I guess by example, we can apply a Machiavellian analysis to a phenomenon we see on the left, right? So you see people get into debates with the left, right? And the left says all sorts of things like, you know, they're interested in universalism, egalitarianism. And it seems like a lot of your guests have noted that they just sort of can shift their formal positions to whatever they want, basically, in the context of a debate. And it's difficult to actually assemble some sort of coherent ideology around what their actual belief set is, which on the right, we actually try to stick to a strict real set of beliefs. And when you look at this from the Machiavellian perspective, you realize that what the left is saying is all formalisms over their real intentions, right? And their real intentions actually don't really have anything to do with their formal intentions. I think without getting into specifics, we can look at, just because of the subject matter, we can look at someone like Vouch, right? And you see him making certain claims about the justifications for age of consent and things like that, right? And what that is an ideological formalism over his real aims. So Machiavellianism is about attempting to understand the real aims of human beings and the real factors that actually motivate them that they seek to implement politically, and sort of glossing over the formalisms they lay over it. Another example, Burnham himself uses FDR as an example. And FDR, you know, made a number of statements before his presidency. That's Franklin Roosevelt, for people who might not know the acronym. And he said things like decreasing government spending by 25%, reducing the bloat in the government agencies. And obviously, FDR did the exact opposite of all of that. And Burnham brings up the question, is FDR simply a liar? Is FDR stupid? And the answer to both of those is no. We know these people, these elites, they're not liars per se. That's not the entirety of what's going on there. And they're certainly not stupid. What's happening is they have a set of formalisms that basically provide the satisfaction of a rational motivation for what they're doing to the people who support them, that might not actually have anything to do with their fundamental aims. And this is what you see from the communists and socialist types as well, right? Their formal aim is this sort of universal equality. Their real aim is not equality. Their real aim is to simply gather power for themselves and to take it away from the evil capitalists that they hate so much. So I think through those examples, we can understand in a better sense what Machiavellianism is actually trying to do in addressing the nature of politics from a scientific perspective, where you actually examine, you strip away all of the unreal aspects, all of the stated ideological aspects, and you try to understand the machinery as it really is, which is actually something that Moldbug does in his work, right? His work.
Hold on a second. It's before you go sure. on. Would you say that a precept of Machiavellianism is that people seek power but justify that process with other more romantic notions?
Absolutely. And this applies to all of us on the right as well. There is very much a sense in which, you know, we need to realize what we are actually after is power. And there are certain ideological layerings we put over that to justify it to ourselves. And this is not to say that these beliefs aren't necessarily sincere, right? Because you actually can have sincere ideological beliefs influencing what you might intend to do with power.
But the beliefs aren't enough, are they?
They're not the fundamental, right? Yeah. So when we look at politics, what we want to do is remove the aspects of your belief in ideology. And that could be libertarianism, Christianity, socialism, you know, whatever. When you're addressing politics, you want to remove the factors of how you wish society were and examine what necessary steps must be taken to actually put it in that configuration. And again, this is not to say that you shouldn't have sincerely held ideological beliefs. Everyone actually will. But the thing is, if you look at any particular derivative belief, this is a word from Pareto. Pareto uses the words residues and derivative. A derivative is something akin to a particular culture or people's point of view, right? A residue is a human permanent, right? So the religious aspect of human beings, the social aspect, the sexual, these are residues. They're permanent fixtures of how human beings are. The derivatives are the particular nature of sexual morality in some particular culture, or the view of the individual and that sort of thing, right? So the Machiavellian is always looking at the residues that apply to human beings, the fundamental motivations that all humans share, regardless of whatever layering is on top of it.
So another way might be that to characterize this might be to say that you might have ideas about how the world should be, but you have to be extremely realistic and hard-nosed and pragmatic about how the world really is here and now so that you can achieve those goals and make the world the way you want it to be. Because, in other words, romance can be debilitating. It can get in the way.
Absolutely. And I think this is a problem we see among my Christian friends in particular on the right. I feel like in the time I've spent speaking with them over the last year, we spent a lot of time, I think, wishing about how society ought to be arranged in relation to...
Can I just say, sorry to interrupt,
yeah,
but I see this constantly on the right. I mean, people will say, in the dissident right, I see this all the time. People will say something like, we should incentivize native births, or we should total ban on immigration from certain countries, right? Yes, but how is that going to happen? You know, that this is what I've started to think. Like, okay, yeah, all right. So we should do that thing you've just said. But how are we going to do it? It's not enough to just say, well, this is what it should be like. Yeah, of course it should be like. But now what? I think we should always be thinking, now what? Instead of thinking, yeah, yeah. And this is a habit that I think we've got into, a sort of coping mechanism, because we're so used to being out of power that we don't even think about how we're actually going to achieve power. I think we've given up without realizing that. I think we delude ourselves. You know, we kid ourselves that, yeah, power is just around the corner. And so we can afford to just dream and just declare, just proclaim policies. But I think that we really need to get far more practical about really everything that we're doing here.
Correct. You know, we spend a lot of time talking about the nature of power, the nature of elite theory, the nature of aesthetics, how this relates to power, how economic theory does as well. But, you know, all of this is for nothing until we realize that what we're saying when we're saying that society should be this way is that I want to make it this way. Therefore, I want to be able to alter society.
Actually, we're saying, I wish society were this way. We're not saying, I want to make it, because or I will make, or I intend to make. That's a crucial psychological difference that I think we're not conscious of. Yeah, because when we say, I wish society were this way, that's basically saying, I wish someone else did this.
Absolutely. So
that is a crucial lack of agency on our own part.
Yeah, and we're all guilty of this, including myself. And I feel that on our little dissident right-wing community, maybe it's not so little anymore, we've spent a lot of time, I think, hoping that some elites will arise and grab hold of our message and take things to the next level. And I think we need to start realizing that that's not going to happen. And it's probably going to be us to some extent who are actually going to have to figure out, okay, we can't simply just talk about what we want. We actually have to figure out practically how we're actually going to get power, which actually has very little to do with our particular ideology. And to do this, you actually really need to have that fundamental drive, what Machiavelli calls virtu, in you. Virtu, it's not virtue. Virtu does not translate to English, but it's something akin to the ambition. It's Italian. You can look it up on Wikipedia, just V-I-R-T-U. And it basically relates to the ambition drive. And the idea is basically that the people who are actually going to ascend to power are the people who want it most, right? If you don't actually want to have power, the ability to command other humans in some formal apparatus, someone else with the higher drive for that is going to take it from you. That's just how power actually works. So we need people who are willing to do it to start thinking this way. And it's possible that some of us may have to figure out how to actually think this way as well, how to actually desire power. What I've seen in one of the reasons I've attracted to the America First Nick Fuentes crowd in particular is because I can see that they have this ambitious drive in them, and they're actually creating formal organizations that produce power, right? Because what power actually is the ability to command people, real people physically. And you need a formal structure to do that. I think one of the ironic things is someone like, Carl Benjamin has, or Sargon, I'm trying to use his real name now since he's trying to retire the old one.
Mr. Lotus.
So he has created a formal organization that he has power within, right? So ironically, Mr. Classical Liberal himself has done more in terms of actually creating power for himself that he can grow into a larger sphere of power than many of the rest of us have done, right? Like, to the extent we're all just sort of in this sort of informal sphere of influence, right? But that's not even close to enough of what we need to actually do to advance our movement to the next level. And I think anything in any of our countries that are actually attempting to build up a formalized power structure, which is one of the first step, basically, that Burnham notes in building power, is you need a formal structure, because without that, there's no way to actually have power express itself, right? And this is just like hiring and firing power, for example. Like, a corporation is a formal power structure, and we need to start producing these things in order to actually grow a real power base, because the way to actually influence elites and society is to have organized minorities, right? We understand that the majority is actually irrelevant. It can always be overruled by organized minorities, which is what's happening to us now.
Yes, indeed. That's a point worth dwelling on, perhaps, for a certain length of time, because it is absolutely, it's obvious in this era that if minorities are not exactly utilized or directed against the majority, they are utilized against the majority. That's the thing. Minorities are not themselves. I mean, in an ideal world, they would, each minority would be a source of power, source of agency for itself. But I think in this age, in this world, minorities don't really have, they're told that they have power. They're told that they have moral weight, but I think they're just used by those who are in power. It's a kind of false flattery. They're told, yes, you're important, yes, you matter, but really they don't. I mean, I don't believe that the powers that be really care about the plight of gay people, for example, or Muslims. And I don't believe that.
I don't believe they do either. We should note here that to some extent, though, these minorities do actually matter, because the regime does at least need the tacit support of the populace to some degree, right? And this is what actually makes this stuff even more dangerous, is that to some extent, the progressive apparatus does actually have to listen to these minority groups. And the conclusion of the book, The Machiavellians, the full title is The Machiavellians, Defenders of Liberty, right? And the idea is that to secure human liberty for yourself and your people, you must think in this realistic Machiavellian manner. And the way in which this idea of the will of the people indirectly ends up expressing itself is not through some act of the majority, but the fact that your elites, if you have elites in competition with each other, they necessarily depend on the organized minority bases that feed power up to them. And in this very indirect way is actually how the will of the people is expressed. And you can secure liberty for yourself because the elites are in contention with each other.
Now, that's a very interesting idea, and I think very useful, very worth bearing in mind. That so how does a minority actually gain agency? It does so by recognizing itself as a thing, which I think is the first step for us to take, because we haven't done that yet, and then demanding that elites listen to it, making themselves something that the elite cannot afford to ignore.
Right. And the interesting thing about the elites listening to it is that if you develop a significant minority interest, you can actually attract, that's how you can actually attract elites that might not even have strongly ideological ties to you. Nevertheless, if they seek power and they're not a part of the existing progressive elite, right, they'll be willing to work with you to displace those other elites that they're in competition with. And that's how you actually control very ambitious people, is that you have the reins on their power base, right? I think ideological alignment is important, but this sort of ideological purity is not quite as important in our leadership as it is the influences behind them, right? So we try to, I think on the right, over the last couple of years, we get too focused into trying to imagine this perfect individual who's ideologically pure, power-driven, is some sort of like divine leader, right? But that's not a thing. There's no human being that's actually this perfect figure that's going to arise. You have these different aspects of a movement distributed throughout it, right? And it's perfectly fine if the core of your ideological base is sort of distributed within your minority interest group, and the leader is simply obeying what that group wants. And, you know, the leader is probably going to just be more interested in personal power than anything. That's the nature of people who end up in these positions. Nevertheless, they are bound to your ideology in some way because you are the one providing them with that power, which is both, you know, manpower and to a large extent finance.
Yeah, indeed. But also perhaps spiritual power as well, because, you know, humans are animated by that. I mean, if people see, and yes, it is often equated with, you know, money for various reasons, but I think that there is a certain energy that emanates from a group, we're using the term a minority, which demands attention. And I think that is... I've interrupted you several times, so I feel bad about doing that, because you're obviously on a train of thought. So I'll try not to interrupt you again. But you were saying about James Burnham and the Machiavellians, and then Pareto and Residues, and then you were going to jump to Moldbach, but I interrupted you. So could you resume that now?
Sure. So yeah, no problem with interruptions. I mean, I definitely want to have a conversation and not just, you know, go on a spiel. But so the Machiavellians is basically Moldbug's primary influence, right? Which he actually makes fairly clear in the open letter and other parts of his blog. And I think that in terms of the path forward for neo-reactionaries, you know, there have been questions recently about what do we do with this theory? Because it doesn't actually tell us that much about what to do. And the answers to what to do are actually deeper into the theory, right? I think we kind of have to humble ourselves and realize that we're not going to be the ones thinking about the political answers here. There are people who have written massive tomes, like Pareto, who are vastly more intelligent than basically anyone you've ever met, right? And these guys have the answers we're looking for in terms of what the steps are in terms of taking our theory about how the current apparatus works and actually altering it in some sense. So I think over the next couple years, as opposed to trying to like come up with our own new ideology appended to neo-reaction, I want to see us dig deeper into some of these older works and go backwards, right? So I've read The Machiavellians. I've read a few, The Web of Subversion, another Burnham book. I want to read a few selections of Pareto himself now and go further into some of these actual elite theorists. Elite theory gets sort of thrown about a lot in our community, but understanding like what elite theory actually is, what the circulation of elites actually is, and what the nature of this phenomenon is, it's really important that we go back, we do the legwork of reading these books and understanding how these mechanisms actually work. I think that's where the answers are in terms of what we need to do next as reactionaries, neo-reactionaries, is not try and figure out how to, you know, create some sort of new appendation to neo-reaction like Moldbug himself is trying to do, but simply to go deeper into this gateway. You know, as I said before we started, neo-reaction to me isn't just like you read Moldbug and Land or something and now you're a neo-reactionary. That's the starting point, right? You read Moldbug and Land and then you're like, oh, here's some interesting author that they reference. I'm going to go read that. Like I mentioned, you know, Economic Agent got really into Thomas Carlyle, which is another one of Moldbug's primary influences, I would say. And that's the correct direction, in my opinion, for us to go in is figure out what actual reactionaries like Carlyle actually thought and did. You know, we're as neo-reactionaries, we're neo-reactionary in the sense that we're modern people trying to rediscover what this older way of thinking actually was. You know, we're not those reactionaries, but we can at least intellectually understand their points of view, their analyses, and try to apply that, maybe not even to our movement, but the next set of people within our movement can learn this information if we can transmit it to them, right?
Oh, absolutely. And I think with NRX is that it does have a reputation for being good at analyzing problems and full of observations about the problems, but not good at coming up with solutions. And it seems like you are, well, what would you say about that? Because it sounds like you are trying to address that.
Yes, well, I mean, Moldbug, of course, being this atheistic, progressive Gen Xer, he doesn't really have very strong opinions on much of anything. And I don't expect him to ever really come up with solutions. People like Spandrel and even Nick Lamb just sort of moved to China as a solution, which I don't think is sufficient for most people. So I would say in terms of solutions, you know, I think I only listened to it for a few minutes with your stream with Distributus, but in the first few minutes, he sort of mentioned how the cathedral is kind of like blasé at this point, where it's so obvious that everyone just sort of gets it. Even if you haven't read about the cathedral at a technical level, the surface level observations and even some of the deeper ones are pretty well known, I think, at this point on the right wing. So it's time to move past that. It's time to really seriously address the successes and failures of various right wing initiatives in both the past and present, and actually just start organizing. Realistically, it's time to start organizing formal organizations that can realistically achieve a specified goal in a logical path, right? One of the things talked about in Burnham's book is that the idea of the difference between logical and illogical action. And I think to a large extent, well, definitely to a large extent, people just behave illogically, right? They don't actually behave in a way where my goal is X. I'm going to do this very specific thing that's going to lead directly to X. We often have some sort of more complex ideological framework we're working in. Like, you know, if I go to church every Sunday and if I pray before every meal and before I go to bed, good things will come to me basically, right? And like, it doesn't matter if you actually believe that. That's just irrelevant. What I'm talking about in terms of logical action is we want to think on a realist material level, on the plane that politics takes place in, the material physical plane. Not politics is not metaphysical as much as we'd like it to be. So we need to start addressing politics from the physical plane in terms of the things that actually drive human beings. And I find that when you actually talk to sort of the masses, right, just sort of regular people who are outside of all this weird ideological stuff, they don't think like us at all in terms of applying metaphysics to what they're doing in their everyday lives. They operate purely on these permanent human residues that Pareto describes that exist throughout all humans everywhere. So it doesn't matter, you know, how hardcore trad you are, you know, how good of a Christian you are, how good of a this or that you are. Most people just aren't like that and don't even care about it, right? They care about real material concerns. And that's the thing that we need to start figuring out how to address. And we have to do that through formal organizations. And that can be things like creating media institutions like Sargon is making.
This is interesting because I think you're right that I think it's possible that people who are intellectual are also romantic. Maybe I don't know why there's a connection there, but there does seem to be a connection. So that that makes it difficult for them to identify with ordinary people who are romantic about their loved ones, but they're not romantic about ideas or ideologies or worldviews or whatever. They're just very much in the here and now. And because I've seen people lament this a lot, that people are just interested, your ordinary guy is just interested in getting a good car and having a hot wife, and he doesn't think about ideas, he doesn't think about what's good for society, he doesn't think about what's the meaning of life. Well, yeah, he doesn't really. He doesn't have that burning need to understand things at a deeper level. But that's not a slight against him. It's just the way he is. It's just the way the ordinary guy is. But meantime, the intellectual does have this. I mean, obviously, there are two kinds of intellectual here. You know, there is the romantic, and then there is the very icy sort of scientific intellectual. But you know, they can coexist in the same person. And I think that makes it, that results in a lot of frustration for especially for right wingers, because we've been losing for so long. So we feel quite distant from everyday people. So we're trying to reach them. We're trying to reach across to persuade them of things. But when we do so, when we speak to them, we try to speak of ideas and ideals and visions, but they talk of, how is that going to affect my bank balance kind of thing.
Well, this is what Donald Trump gets right in how he operates. What he and the solution to this problem is to actually come up with our own formalisms over our real aims to promulgate to people. And this is what Donald Trump does, right? Is he has his own real goals and agenda. It might be his agendas are things that it's pro-American. It's you know, win this trade war with China. It's defeat certain progressive, you know, he has the whole patriotic education initiative, and people like this, but you have to layer this in with a sort of patriotism that appeals to the mass man. And you have to do certain things that are in their interest, such as, you know, give them $1,200 in stimulus checks or something like that. Right. You have to come up with a formalism that is related to your real goals, but isn't necessarily fully descriptive of it. You basically just have to do what politicians do and say things that people like so that they will support you. And that's this isn't nefarious, right? It's simply how politics actually works. So if we want to expand our movement to the masses, basically, we have to do what politicians do. And we have to understand that there's basically a certain level of fraud, if you want to put it that way, that's actually necessary to actually organize movements like this, simply because of how human beings are, is you sort of have to come up with these aphorisms and platitudes about, you know, what you intend to do and, you know, how you want society should to be, even if that isn't really necessarily something you're strictly going to implement.
Again, I think that intellectuals are frustrated with politicians for doing that kind of thing. For the word platitudes, you know, we moan about politicians doing that kind of stuff all the time. But you're absolutely right. It obviously works. It's obviously something that politicians do because it works. So I think that But again, it's like, okay, so we're going to just come out with platitudes in order to please people. That sounds kind of low. I mean, you obviously understand that.
Absolutely, it does. It's certainly distasteful, right? And I think intellectual people have a distaste for it. I have a distaste for it, but I'm trying to understand what Machiavellianism actually is. And this is what it is, right? It's approaching the problem of politics based on how people really are and how things really work and not how we would like them to work. It doesn't matter how much I would like to, I mean, just last night I was hanging out with my brother and some of his friends, and I explained neo-reaction to them, right? Just completely normal people who are totally clueless about any politics to the right of conservatism, right? And I mostly just do this just to experiment, really, right? And it's so far over their heads that, you know, there's no chance of this ever succeeding, right? And this little experiment, you know, confirms what I'm learning from Burnham and Machiavelli here, in that what we wish was so simply has no bearing on how we actually have to conduct politics. We have to conduct politics as it is, and now not how we want it to be. Politics is never going to be clean. It's never going to be free of force and fraud, right? And that's simply how it is. And we have to figure out how to make ourselves willing to address politics on this level. And it's not that we would lie, right? It's not lying. It's simply producing the correct formalisms or ideology that can appeal to people in a way that will convince them to support you. That way, whatever your real aims are, which I think in our case are benevolent, I think probably you would even say that on the left, right? Many of them actually have real aims that they think are for the good of society, and we have our own aims that we think are for the good of society. And these are sincerely held beliefs, but you can't simply go around explaining your sincerely held beliefs to people expecting that that's actually going to produce political power, right? Because that's just not how it works.
Yeah, indeed. And again, that's a problem that I see on the right all the time, that people think, well, we should just tell people the truth and they'll accept it. No, they won't.
No, absolutely not. Now there are certain human truths that Pareto points out, for example, in his residues that can be appealed to. And the ones of these on our side, so to speak, are the class two residues, which are what he calls residues of persistence, which is basically the human instinct to keep what is persistent. This is basically the conservative instinct. And this has to do with the desire to preserve family and or the tribe or the nation, even beyond the living, right? We have this instinct to preserve what we have for people as of yet born, and even the past, right? We even conduct our politics on the right in relation to people who are no longer even alive, which logically doesn't actually even make any sense, right? But
hold on a second. What do you mean by that? That we conduct our politics. What do you mean?
Well, we have an ancestor respect, right? We have this idea that we're obligated in some sense to preserve what our ancestors created for us, and behave in a way that is becoming to what they would think of us, even though they simply don't exist in the material world anymore, right? They're bones. And it's from a material perspective, it's completely illogical to actually act based on the remains of the dead, right? But nevertheless, people don't behave purely logically, and people do behave in this way with a certain respect for the dead. And this is a very right-wing phenomenon in particular. And this is a residue, right, that we can layer over some formalism over. Often it would be a Christian one, right? But it could even be pagan. It doesn't actually matter what the particular formalism is. It's the idea that there are certain human permanents that can be appealed to. And I think it is the right choice for that many of us have made to try and appeal to this idea of family, nation, ethnos, right? Because that is a human permanent that cannot actually be eradicated, no matter how much the left tries. And that is one of our tickets, I think, to displacing the class one elite. Class one residues, there's actually six of them. The class one residue is the residue of combination, right? So Pareto identifies this human permanent nature to come up with essentially arbitrary combinations of things and produce something new out of it, right? It's in some sense the creative impulse. And you see this all the time. We even saw this, what was it, like 2 days ago. You know, the star of Bethlehem and Saturn and Jupiter are arranged in a certain way. And this means something to us, right? Even though none of these things have anything to do with each other. The star is millions of light years away, two random planets. Like, this is just meaningless stuff. But nevertheless, there are many events in our life, many traditions that are just sort of produced via a combination of things. You might consider this sort of received wisdom in a sense, right? You know, anything from certain rituals that the ancients did in terms of, you know, you'd come up with a rain dance, right? A rain dance has absolutely nothing to do with whether or not it's going to rain. Nevertheless, human beings have this instinct to sort of combine and manipulate things into something new. This is our elite right now. They're the class one elite. The class one elite, the class one residues are combinatorial, speculative, manipulative, configurable. This type of human behavior is all about manipulating things, manipulating numbers, laws, regulations, economies.
I've seen that this year with things being, you know, the elites manipulating things on the ground in order to achieve certain goals.
Moving 300 people to some tiny village in Wales, right? so this is what they do, right? This is our current elite, is the class one type of elite, where their entire method is based on simply reconfiguring things over and over and over again. This is the entire way the left operates, I would say, is on these class one residues, where they're obsessed with simply trying to reconfigure the entire world into such a way as things simply work as they want them to, right? The problem is that is not the entirety of the way human beings are, right? And the way out here is with the class two elite, right? So Trump, I think, and there are people in all of our countries like this that are elites of the class two type, and I guess to put it in a clearer way, Athens, ancient Athens, was mostly a class one type of society. And from this, you see a lot of creative impulse.
Yeah, describe class one and then describe class two.
Yeah, so class one residues, the residues of combinations. It's the combination of various elements to allegedly produce some outcome, basically. And it's the creation of systems and ideologies, right? So the entire set of combined knowledge that humans produce is based on this class one type behavior. It's not a bad behavior, right? It's simply a permanent type of human behavior to produce things out of combinations. And it creates new things, right? It's a creative impulse. It's not entirely logical. It's mostly pseudo-logical, right? A lot of our creative impulse doesn't have a logical flow behind it. We simply combine things in a way that seem to make sense to us and produce new things. This is something that Athens did. Sparta, on the other hand, was a class two, more so. I mean, you have mixtures in both societies, right? But Sparta is much more of a class two residue type of society. And this type of society is more concerned with the preservation of persistence and religious zeal, preventing things from changing, preserving things as they are. Sparta literally banned innovation, right? That's like a purely class two type of behavior in which all change is basically undesirable. And of course, to have a healthy society, you actually need both of these working together, right? And these were the weaknesses ultimately in both Athens and Sparta, is that they had too much of one, not enough of the other. You aren't sufficiently adaptive if you aren't able to tap into both types of residues, right? This is the problem and the weakness of our current elites, is that they're purely class one, which basically means they depend entirely on combinations and fraud, and they are unwilling to use force against other elites, right? That's the key, is the class two type of behaviors, as you might imagine, tend to go more with the willingness to use force. And this is actually necessary within elites in order to stop them from becoming too degenerative. You actually need elites who are willing to use force against other elites to sort of keep the proper balance in the culture.
What we do see in this day and age is that our elites are prepared to use force against ordinary people.
But not each other, right?
Right.
And that's the key here, right, is that in order to... When we're analyzing society in this way, we're really only talking about what the elites are doing. And this may be related to the majority of people in terms of the minorities that back them. And you're going to have more of one of these classes backing the other. But ultimately, what we're concerned with in our society is what the elites are doing and whether or not you have a sufficient balance of conflict within the elites, circulation of the elites, and a combination of both of these types of residues, right? And what we see now is the elites are simply not using to use force against each other. And the elites are also very closed right now. And they're becoming degenerated, detached from society. And, basically this is going to be their downfall, and it could take the entire society with it, right? As it has in the past.
Well, I would ask you which, because obviously you're implying that there are multiple elites and that they are in conflict, but they refuse to use force against each other. Who are these? Can you name these multiple elites rather than, because obviously we often speak about just one elite, like the elite. So where are the multiple elites, and what are the conflicts between them?
The second class of elites are basically all of the powerful people who are excluded from the progressive club. I would say an even better example than Donald Trump of the rogue elite, as we would call them, the second class of elite, would be someone like General Flynn, right? This is a guy who, he is an elite, absolutely. I mean, Pentagon general, right? This is an elite person, yet he is excluded from the ruling class of elites, right? And you always have this phenomenon where there are ambitious people who are not in the ruling elite who want to become a part of that ruling elite, right? And this is actually necessary to keep the society active, adaptive, and healthy, and prevent it from becoming totalitarian. So obviously the figurehead of this class two elite that is attempting to displace the current one is centered around Donald Trump in the United States. And there are many people associated with him that perhaps are even a better representative of the class two type of person. I think someone like General Flynn, for example, has said clearly that he's willing to use force against the existing class of elites, right? And I mean literally using the executive power to make arrests, suspend certain governments, that sort of thing, right? I mean, this is what force actually is. And the elite class that exists in society, because they're entirely class one and unwilling to use force, they're actually extremely vulnerable to this. If some elite comes in, basically the lion type versus the fox type, which depends on cunning, that is willing to use force, they will be completely washed away, right? There's no combination of manipulations you can do with wealth or rules or anything that can actually withstand an army, right? And this has been persistent throughout history. The only real thing that keeps power is human force, right? It doesn't matter how rich you are. It doesn't matter how much you can manipulate ideology and money. At the end of the day, if you don't have the ability to prevent some other power from using force against you, then you really have nothing at all, in a sense, right? And this is what we're looking at in terms of the current circulation of elites, right? Is we're waiting for some second type of elite, some competing elite to emerge that simply willing to use force against the entrenched elite class and remove them.
I agree, but then if that rival elite is yet to emerge, then how can you say that the current elite isn't willing to use force against its rivals?
Well, so far basically what you would expect is the type of political assassinations you saw in ancient Rome, right? That's a case where the elites were absolutely willing to use force against each other, right? But in modern times, you don't see that. You don't see that in the last several hundred years in the U.S., really. I mean, political assassinations from one elite class to another is extremely rare. It's simply something they don't do, right? The elites are not really willing to do this to each other. That's why, for example, I've never been concerned, right, for like the safety of President Trump, right? Because you have this unfortunate history of political assassination of presidents in the U.S. But when you understand like the nature of the elite, you understand that they're simply not willing to do that to each other because they understand their own vulnerability in this respect, right? The elite operates purely on combinations of economic manipulations, of the manipulations of moving people about and regulating and this sort of thing. They don't actually prevent other elites from gaining power by using force against them. And basically the first group of elites that emerge that are willing to do this will displace the existing one. And there's plenty examples throughout history of this happening, right? Happens all the time. Actually, it's actually common throughout history for this to happen, right? I mean, pick your European country and you can look at the last several hundred years of its history and you can see this happen all the time, where the entrenched elite class simply gets removed by force by some other group that's willing to do it. And the reason that happens is because the elite degenerates, right? When you don't have this conflict between elites and one of them basically secures total control, as has happened now, the only way to actually remove that is through an elite class that's willing to use force. So it's kind of an inevitability. And I think we're hoping that the current president is actually going to do that in the United States. People have different views on that. And, you know, the key here, though, is that this has to be done within the elites, right? We're not talking about, like, going out into the streets and doing some sort of political violence. Obviously, you shouldn't do that. That's not advised. What we're talking about is actually, like, legal force, right? Like, the president of the United States can legally use force against certain aspects of the government and the entrenched elite. He actually has all of the power necessary at this very moment to actually do that purely within the bounds of the laws provided by the United States. And the question is he going to do it? Is someone in the future going to do it? I think that's what we're looking at in terms of how we're expecting to get these people out of the way, because that is how you always remove the type of elite that relies on combinations, is eventually people get fed up with it and a competing elite class emerges that is willing to simply remove them. And it doesn't have to be particularly retributive even, right? I mean, in the past, you know, in ancient societies, this sort of thing could be very, very brutal, right? But it doesn't have to be that way.
Yeah, what I was going to ask, because I was going to wonder about that. I was going to ask, surely the reason that the elites today don't just kill rivals and so on is that it would be visible.
Yes.
But then again, there are certain examples, people who have fallen foul of Hillary Clinton and so on.
Of course, but of course, those aren't the power ruling elites, right? So they're totally willing to use even that level of force against their rivals. But the problem is, if they do it against each other, that basically opens up the can of worms that will annihilate them, basically, right? So it's the risk is simply far too high for them to actually do this to each other. So you saw this happening frequently in ancient Rome, right? Towards the end of the late Republic, with the Gracchi, with the civil wars that occurred within Rome, the social war and the actual civil war with Caesar and Pompey. This was actually a fairly common occurrence, right? And both sides were actually willing to do it to some extent, which actually made it safer for them to do it, right? Because the problem is when your elite becomes totally reliant on combinations, the moment force is actually used against them, it will overwhelm them completely, right? So I think that's the situation we're looking at right now, and it sounds kind of crazy, but if you think about it, right, if the president decided to actually fully use the executive power in the United States against the entrenched elite, they would stand absolutely no chance against that, right? Presuming he has the mechanisms in place to command the appropriate parts of the executive branch that can do things like make arrests, right? Like, you don't even have to, like, this doesn't even have to get into the realm of bloodshed necessarily, right? I mean, arrest is forced, right? I mean, you can arrest people. You can confiscate their property, right? That's a type of force. There's an executive order we've talked about a lot on Academic Agents Channel, right? So we need to keep in mind that when I talk about using force, historically, this is often violence because of how human beings are, but that's not necessarily what we mean, right? I mean, any type of force levied from one elite to another. And the moment that is done, I think that's when we will see the regime actually change in the United States, because the elite class will be opened up again, right? That is the only way at this point that the elite class will actually be opened up again, is if they're actually physically removed, as Hop would put it.
Well, it just reminds me of certain memes, which we need to go into. So would you say that, well, I'm curious, because you were saying that we need to learn about Machiavellianism and so on, but now you seem to be saying that Trump could do all of this right now.
Yes, he could, and the question is...
if he doesn't, then all of this more long-term stuff comes into play.
Yeah, if he fails, then we simply need to realize that we need to start more from square one, I think. I mean, I think... Putting faith in him is kind of a long shot, right? Because if he gets ousted now, we basically have a hell of a lot of work in front of us to try and generate someone new like him who's actually going to be the lion to the fox, right? And that's going to take a really long time to do. And it's something we need to work on either way, I think. No matter what happens in the U.S. with Trump, right, we're not going to stop what we're doing. So I'm not saying that, like, we need to basically put all our hopes on him, but I'm saying that he has the potential to be. He's given off the signals that he has the potential to be this type of class two elite, as opposed to the class one. But he may ultimately prove that he is also unwilling to use force. He's projecting that, you know, he may be willing to do it. There's people in his administration that are saying, yes, let's do it. But ultimately, that's totally meaningless unless you actually are willing to use that legal force against your opponents. You simply need an elite class that has the courage to actually do that. The way they have the courage to actually do that is to have the tacit support of the people, right? And this is where the circle back on your question there, this is how it relates to us, right? And this is why things like the MAGA march, et cetera, are so important, because in order for elites to actually be willing to use force, they have to have the understanding that this class two type of residue is present enough in the society that the society is willing to back that, right? Like, the people of the United States have to be willing to say, yes, we want our new elite class to use force to remove these corrupt, entrenched elites and get them out of our way, right? That's the only condition under which that any type of elite would be willing to do that. They can't simply do it, you know, arbitrarily, right? Because they would lose that battle of force. So this is where we come in.
Right. Okay. Earlier, and by the way, I don't know if someone has said that entropy has stopped working. If people could try it just to verify one way or the other, whether it's okay, I would appreciate that. And so the link will be posted there just now in the live chat. So one other thing, you said that it's inevitable that one elite will attack the incumbent elite when the incumbent elite degenerates. And I would ask you, what are the signs of that an elite has degenerated? And is the current, presumably you do think that the current elite is degenerate?
Yeah, basically, according to Burnham and Pareto, the way they would describe a degenerated elite is basically when the circulation of elites ceases. They're not sufficiently open. It's also the case when the residues of the elites become out of sync with the residues of the people, right? So the masses tend to have more of this type of class one residue where they care about, you know, family and preserving tradition and religion and this sort of thing. And a degenerated elite loses all connection to this, right? And they become purely focused on these class one types of combinatorial behaviors and cease actually caring about the conservative instincts of the people. So an elite degenerates basically when it no longer has a sufficient quantity of these class two type residues in it in order to actually be correctly aligned with the people. They need to lead, right? And in order to actually have that process, those class two residues present in the elite, they have to actually be open, right? So they have to actually be open to people like, you know, in the UK, Nigel Farage, in the United States, Donald Trump. Like, if they're not open to that, then they're going to actually degenerate because they're going to continuously lose all connection to these class two residues that actually exist in the mass of society. So that is basically what a degenerated elite looks like.
So it's one that's detached and from the public and flimsy.
Yeah, it's detached and it's weak. So it's weak to even the smallest amount of force, right? Like, that's the ironic thing is, you know, people talk about like Boogaloo and all that, right? But what it would look like if force was used against the current elites, you probably wouldn't even notice it, right? Like, that's how flimsy they are, is that, you know, some leader willing to actually use force could probably just make a few hundred arrests and, you know, that would basically be it, right? I mean, they would be removed so easily and quickly, you would have never even thought it possible, right? Because they've degenerated so far into these purely combinatorial type behaviors where all they're able to do is shift around numbers and money and people and try to spread certain ideologies. That's their only tool. And when you only have that one tool, then you lose your capabilities to remain adaptive to new situations that arise. And of course, that's what destroys any life form, right? Is when it's no longer sufficiently adaptive to the environment that it's actually in. And as we see, the elites are now in this struggle with their own society, right? Because they cannot adapt to what the American people to a sufficient degree actually want, right? The American people on a large scale they do reject what the elites are actually trying to foist upon us, right? And that's ultimately what's going to be their undoing, because there's no way that they can actually erase these permanent human behaviors of preservation and family and nation, right? No matter how hard they try.
Yes, but they can change the people.
It can change very slowly over time. That is true.
I mean, the elites can change the public.
They can do that. We may be in a situation like that. It's possible that if the elites resist this type of circulation for long enough, it's possible that they could actually entirely replace us with new types of people who have no attachment to their nation or ethnicity or traditions, and that actually would basically constitute a total victory for them. I think they still have a long way to go before they get there, and there are going to be, I think, more competitors emerging over the next couple of decades, if we don't succeed in overturning them now, that will actually seek to undo what they've done on a very serious level. But you are correct that there is a path where what we're talking about here in the circulation of elites may not happen if they very carefully manipulate the societies by, as they do, moving things around in their combinations. Like I referenced, you know, importing, you know, people from the Middle East and Africa to some small village in Wales, right? Or like putting certain economic restrictions in place, making it to where you can't go outside, making it to where, you know, you have to wear the mask, you have to get vaccinated, you have to you pay half your, you can't own property, that sort of thing, right? So it's absolutely possible that there is a combination of things that they can do that will secure their power for a very long time. I don't think that's particularly likely. I think if you look at what happens when elites do this in civilizations, they always end up getting overturned eventually by some force. It could be possible that in our new age of accelerated technology that they can actually figure out a way to fundamentally alter human behaviors. You know, none of these things are necessarily permanent. They've been permanent historically, and I think we have reason to believe that they will continue. But there is a way, I think, although a slim one, that the elites could prevent this from happening.
All right. Well, that's overall a fairly optimistic message, actually. So, okay. Well, we'll move on to some super chats. So somebody reckoning says, Merry Christmas, brothers. Is it too late to suggest guests? I would like to nominate and nominate someone. Yes, it is too late at this point, but thank you, and I will bear that name in mind for next year. Sensum Communum, Merry Christmas again. I often watch Charlemagne on Academic Agent's Cigar Stream. I always enjoy his cogent appraisal of what's going on at any given time. So please pass on my salutations to him. There you go.
Thank you very much.
All right. And Wandering Sparg says, thank you for arranging and hosting all of these streams, especially given this year's challenges. Well, thank you very much. Okay, and there was this highbrow stuff is good and useful, but we could do with a bit more outrageous Yuletide merriment and laughter. Yes, I know, and perhaps I should have borne that in mind. It's for Christmas Eve, it should perhaps be more light, so I'll bear that in mind for next year. But nonetheless, I think that the three streams so far have been quite good, and I hope that you're enjoying them. But anyway, thank you for that suggestion. So, okay, are there any final things you'd like to say, Charlemagne, about the future of NRX?
I would say we need to start investigating the influences behind NRX. Burnham is one of them. Carlyle is one of them. And the elite theorists like Pareto, Mosca, we need to understand them to some degree. We need to dig into the background, the roots of NRX. The idea of, I think, appending to it is the wrong way to go. We need to go not in a forwards direction exactly, but we need to go backwards into the things we have not yet discovered within the pool of knowledge that it presents to us. I think one of the great things about NRX is it's more about the discovery of forgotten knowledge that we need to relearn and understand again, that humans used to understand. And that's where I want to see us go. And I think I'm going to orient my channel probably more towards that in the next maybe 3 years or so. I'm probably going to do a video on some of the stuff I've talked about tonight and move away from investigating like Moldbug in particular. I think we've kind of exhausted the modern neo-reactionaries, and we need to look into their influences.
All right. Well, that all sounds quite interesting. And there's obviously a lot of possibility for development and discovery, and as you say, rediscovery of old forgotten things. So I wish you luck with that. Well, people can find you on your channel, which is linked below, and they can hear you on Academic Agents Cigar Streams. So that should be, I'm sure people will join you there as well. So thank you. Is there something you want to say?
You can also check out my blog. I started a Substack blog. It's charlemagne.substack.com. My first entry there was actually a report on what it was like hanging out with the Proud Boys in D.C. About 2 weeks ago, I think, chasing around Antifa in the middle of the night. So that was pretty interesting. I may actually attempt to turn that into a more regular and possibly even physical publication at some point. So over the next few years, obviously. But I think, like I've kind of said here, I want to expand outside of mere video making. I want to see more of us doing that and get into actual physically productive organizations that can build power and not just, talk about ideology all day. I would also mention, so every year I set a goal for myself. 2018 was get 1,000 subs. 2019's secret goal was get 10,000 subs, which I also achieved, which was great. 2020's goal was to be invited on Millennial. So I thank you very much for inviting me here. You've helped me achieve my secret goal for the year. I never tell anyone about the goals because I don't want to inadvertently influence them. So I was very glad to participate here today. It's been great. This really is an excellent tradition, for the right wing. I mean, what we have going on here, what you and all the other guests have done, I think everyone really looks forward to this every year. I hope to see this tradition continue far into the future, even beyond your channel. I think it's really great for the community. I think that's it. I look forward to the next one.
Well, thank you very much for those very kind words, and it's very nice thoughts. I'm glad that it does matter to people. It's something that I'm glad that I can do this for the community. So there we go. And it's been I've enjoyed having you on. I did decide quite a few months ago. I can't remember when it was that I invited you, but I remember thinking, yes, I've got to have these types on this year, and you were the one of the main ones. So, all right, well, excellent. I'll be back in 35 minutes with Travis LeBlanc, and that's probably going to be, as I've said before, probably a unique opportunity to hear him. He says he's not going to do it again, and he's never done it before, so that should be quite interesting. In the meantime, thank you, Charlemagne, for taking part in Millennial 2020.
Thank you.
All right. Excellent. I'll see you all in a wee while.